Hello, everyone. Happy Monday. I'm happy to be here because we're going to look at the seven steps to awakening here. And in a way, you know, teaching is always selfish. It's divine selfishness. You know, we hear that we teach what we need to learn. And this time that I requested from Dove is really, really, really selfish. I, as you guys know, have felt to have a year of silence in 2012. And it cannot be absolute silence. But it can be a whole lot more silence than I've experienced in the previous years. And that's what it is. And I'm also learning more about what silence is. And how to bring silence even into the times that I'm interacting with people. And the book that is guiding me in this year of silence, I think many of you know, is a book called The Seven Steps to Awakening. It was put together by a man named Michael Langford, but all it really is a collection of quotes from a number of teachers. The teachers that are quoted in the book are Ramana Maharshi, Annamalai Swami, Vasistha and Sankara, Nisargadatta Maharaj, Muru Ganar, and Sadhu Om. And I went over the introduction last week, so some of you heard the introduction, and you know that a part of the recommendation is that you read the quote at least three times, each quote, and then you write about the purpose of the quote in your own words and what you can do to bring that into practice in your life. And someone is asking, can the book be downloaded to an iPad? No, so far I've only found it in paperback. I have not found an e-copy. If anybody does find an e-copy, let me know and I'll let everyone else know. Because I'm sure people would love that. I would love that. And then after you read each quote and write about it in the way asked, he also recommends that you read over what you have written, he says, hundreds of times. And I'm doing that. That's the way I'm practicing the book. And this teaching is one of my opportunities to read over the quotes and what I've written hundreds of times. So it's just one of those opportunities. This morning I found myself, I didn't think I would do this, but I guess you never know what you're going to do. It's one of the suggestions he makes, but I thought, oh, I won't do that. And I did. This morning I actually made a recording reading from what I have written in my Seven Steps journal. And I feel like while I am doing dishes, cooking, you know, things like that, that I can be playing the recording and listening. Obviously, I'm finding this extremely helpful. As I mentioned last week, everything that I'm doing with this book is coming from my heart. I'm not doing anything out of any sense of coercion, you know, or any sense of, you know, this is how it has to be done. You know, it's just what I want to do. Yeah, Julie says the same for her. And Gemini is saying the first 54 quotes are on the Yahoo group Eternal Bliss. And yeah, the guy who manages the Yahoo group Eternal Bliss is the guy who gathered the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening, together. And the name, you want me to type in the name of the book? It's called The Seven Steps to Awakening. That's the name of the book. The Seven Steps to Awakening. So last week I went over the introduction, and then I went over the first two quotes. And so today I'll just continue by beginning with quote three and moving forward from there. But before I do that, what I would like to do is for us just to take a moment of silence So if y'all would join me in that, I would appreciate it. Amen. All right. So, I'm going to begin by reading the quote, and then I'll just read what I wrote in my journal when I went over the quote, and then if I, you know, feel to say anything about it, I will. I mean, we'll just see what happens. By the way, anyone else who is doing the seven steps, if you are actively doing the seven steps and you feel that you want to share something from what you wrote in your seven steps journal, please put up your hand. I'm happy to share with you. But I will ask that we keep it to the seven steps. I'd like to really be focused on that. So I'm not looking for an open discussion. This is a time of silence, and in this case, silence means very focused on what we're doing. So it's not just an open discussion to say whatever you think, but if you're actively doing the seven steps, if that is your practice, and you want to share, you feel a calling to share from your seven steps journal on the same quote that I am on, I invite you to put your hand up and share. All right? I would love that. So grab your notebooks. All right, so I'm going to begin on page 17 with quote number 3. Again, right now the quotes that we are in are from Ramana Maharshi. And here's the quote. When knowledge, marred by doubt and error, disappears in true awareness, clear and pure, one thus established firmly in self-being, free from falsehood, has crossed over to the further shore of the river of knowledge. When knowledge marred by doubt and error disappears in true awareness, clear and pure, one thus established firmly in self-being, free from falsehood, has crossed over to the further shore of the river of knowledge. All right, and this is what I wrote in my journal regarding the purpose and how I can practice it in my life. Total self-abidance is the goal and purpose of spiritual practice. It is why I do this. I need to practice being aware of awareness much, much more than I have been, because full, complete, and total abidance without a trace of ego, without a trace of false self-identity, is my goal. So for me, that particular quote was pointing out that the only true goal of spirituality is complete and full realization of self without even a trace of ego. And my journal entry was just agreeing that that is my purpose. And that is why I want to up the ante on my own practice, right? My heart is calling me into even a stronger, you could use the word more firm or more consistent practice than I have participated in the past. I really want to do this. Okay, quote number 4. And again, I'm watching four hands if anybody else wants to share from their 7 Steps journal. Even the knowledge sense perceived of the world without has for its ground the self above. To search for knowledge somewhere else apart from that is but to grasp the shadow, not the substance. Now, interestingly, by the way, this was already one of my favorite quotes before this book came to me. It's credited to Ramana Maharshi here, but the exact wording of the quote actually comes from Muru Ganar. Muru Ganar was an awakened devotee of Ramana Maharshi, and Muru Ganar took what Ramana Maharshi taught and wrote it in a very, very long poetry writing. It's called The Garland of Guru's Sayings. And as some of you know, I've been reading that book for a few years and I adore it. And all of the Ramana Maharshi quotes in The 7 Steps to Awakening actually come from the Muru Ganar book, The Garland of Guru's Sayings, all of which were read and approved by Ramana Maharshi and based on his teachings. But this particular one that we're reading now, number 4, was already one of my favorites from the Garland of the Guru's Sayings. Here it is again. Even the knowledge sense perceived of the world without has for its ground the self above. To search for knowledge somewhere else apart from that is but to grasp the shadow, not the substance. All right, this is my journal. All things and all experience is made of self. So not to know self is not to know anything. I need to notice when I have become caught up in form of the world or thought and return myself to the search or purpose for knowing all by knowing self. And one moment, Jamie wants to go out. So what this says to me is, you know, we talk about the illusion of the world. And on the one hand, the world is an illusion. On the one hand. On the other hand, it isn't. And you may have heard this before. What is real is everywhere, all that is. And what is illusion is when that fact is missed and something else is seen or perceived, something other than that truth, that reality. And so what this quote says, in fact, I'm going to read the Ramana Maharshi quote again. He says, even the knowledge since perceived of the world without, right, everything that you perceive as a part of the world has for its ground the self above. That's all that there really is the self. To search for knowledge somewhere else apart from that is but to grasp the shadow, not the substance. So the self is the true substance of everything, or some people may call it God, or A Course in Miracles calls it love. It's the truth of all that is. And so the only way to really know everything, you could say the only way to intimately know what anything is to know the self. If you don't know the self, then you also cannot truly know anything else, because that is what it is. And I notice Julie has her hand up, so I am turning the mic over to her.
Hi, thank you, Regina. I really liked this quote, too. I've always been very drawn to Ramana Maharshi, and as I was reading through these, I was really struck by quite a few of them. I wrote as the purpose, what I wrote for the purpose is just very simple. Again, encourages us to realize all real knowledge comes from the self, the true self, our higher spirit. Everything else is illusion. And then what I wrote as the practice is actually what came to my mind was to meditate on the I am that I am, which is actually, you know, in the inner Ramana, he gives us that practice to meditate on the I am that I am, to sort of reorient ourselves to our truth. And I've been doing an I am that I am meditation for a couple of months now. I've noticed a remarkable difference in that I am able to more quickly shift my awareness of who I am from Julie, the little self, to the truth of who I am. It seems like that is happening more quickly. And I feel like that is the greatest, one of the greatest meditations we can do, is just to focus on. And when I was doing these, over the last couple of months, when I was doing these I am that I am meditations, I kind of had a revelation about that sentence. And what I was doing was picturing the third eye, or this light in my third eye area of my forehead. And I was picturing that as my higher self. And as I was saying that phrase, I had a little bit of a revelation, because I would say, I am that I am. And eventually it became, I am that, the light. that became the light, my true self. And so I was telling myself, I am that I am. The I am that I think I am is equal to the I am presence that is my true self. And it's sort of like that is removed and becomes an equal sign. They are the same thing, the one and the same. I am that I am. And so that meditative practice has been very useful for me. And that was the practice that came to me as I was reading this particular quote. So thank you for letting me share. I'll probably share again after quote number 6, because I love quote number 6. That's my favorite. Thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing. I really enjoy that a lot. All right, let's look at quote number 5 then. Quote number 5. Whatever notion may arise, never to let it live or grow, but to turn it that very instant, firm and stern, back to its source and merge it there. This is robust, intense detachment. And actually, that's another one of my favorite quotes from the Garland of Gurus Sayings. Whatever notion may arise, never to let it live or grow, but to turn it that very instant, firm and stern, back to its source and merge it there. This is robust, intense detachment. All right, so I wrote, notice the thoughts that are attempting to be born into stories, and instead of following the thought, look at where the thought originates from. Focus attention there, on the stillness of source. And for me, occasionally, this takes great focus to practice. You know, the stories that are less interesting to me, and there are many, many stories at one time that would have been interesting that are less interesting to me. And it's very, 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 very easy for me to see the story being born into the mind. And it's very easy for me to recognize it as a story. And instead of following it, just looking at the silence from which it came and focusing on the silence, and the story just fades before it ever really got its feet on. But there are stories that apparently still have what I would call an unhealed root within me. And because the root of the story is unhealed, the story somehow seems to have more power to it. And it is much more difficult, if not seemingly impossible, for me to follow the thought back to its source, the silence, and to tune into the silence and never let the thought of the story be born. So this is just something in those cases where it seems to be more difficult for me, this is where the additional focus is going. The additional focus on these stories that seem to have more interest, probably due to an unhealed root in me and my mind. So I'm really trying to notice then when those stories are being born and to practice with them, going back to where they originate and staying with the stillness and just... That's all there is to say about that. The main point that I wanted to make, I suppose, is that sometimes it feels easy to do, and sometimes it seems to take a lot more focus and intention on my part to do it. And again, I think the difference is the interest, which is based on the root. All right. Number 6. Many are the ills that flow from mixing with mad folks, afflicted with turbid minds and rattling tongues. Best friendship is with those good men whose minds are dead and who abide in the pure silence of awareness. I'll read that again. Many are the ills that flow from mixing with mad folks, afflicted with turbid minds and rattling tongues. Best friendship is with those good men whose minds are dead and who abide in the pure silence of awareness. When I read this, it reminded me of a quote that might come from the Bible, but I'm not certain that it does, but it was a quote that was quoted to me over and over and over again as a teenager when I was one of Jehovah's Witnesses. And that quote was, "Bad associations spoil useful habits." That's what it reminded me of. So that is how I started my journal entry. Bad associations spoil useful habits. I can continue to avoid taking part in group conversations that I recognize as not helpful, and I can become more discerning so that I withdraw myself from conversations I may still be taking part in. Even more, I need to watch my desire to share my thoughts in what appears to be private one-on-one conversations. I need to pass on that temptation. I need to become more comfortable with my own silence when other bodies are around and nothing useful or purposeful is arising to be said. This is something I am paying great attention to, which is I already was pretty well practiced at, you know, when there were people around the table and they were beginning to get into a conversation that I recognized as not helpful, I would just get up and, you know, go do dishes, take out the trash, you know, something, you know, just move away from the conversation as a whole. But where I think the weakness was in me was when I felt like I was in a private one-on-one conversation, I might still share something that really should just be forgotten. I talked about this last week, and I remember Julie commented on this right after my teaching. something that just should be completely let go and not even held to in the mind, otherwise discussed in a one-on-one private conversation. So I am watching that now, and I am seeing sometimes that the ego wants to agree with someone when they're saying something, or that there may be a story that's rising up in me that wants to be told, and I am just passing on that. That is one of my silent practices. I just let it go back to the dust, or the silence from which it came, and not share the story, not give it any more strength. All right, Julie, you had said you might want to share after 6. Do you want to do that? I can turn the mic over to you. Okay.
Yeah, I love this quote. When I first read it, it literally made me laugh out loud. And I think it's not so much what he's saying, but how he said it. It just really, you can tell the guy had a little bit of a sense of humor. You know, many are the ills that flow from mixing with mad folks afflicted with turbid minds and rattling tongues. Quite poetry, actually. But what I wrote is just that the purpose of this is to just make us aware that there's a great deal of our mind that is still sleeping. And it takes a great deal of willingness to want to awaken from this dream. You know, it takes a great deal of willingness for us to stop valuing this experience, this world that we have so come to love and value, even when it causes us a lot of pain and suffering. And so we have to be vigilant. What this brought in mind for me was the whole concept of being vigilant for God and His kingdom, especially when we are around those who perhaps are still very much asleep and dreaming. We have to be steadfast in our desire to awaken when in their presence. That will not only help us, but it will help them as an extension of our mind. And then as a practice, they wrote, abide with those, and this is interesting because somebody just a couple of days ago, I was talking to somebody and they said, do you think it's all helpful to be in the presence of advanced teachers and gurus? And I said, sure it is. They're you, and they're just a part of your mind that is seemingly more awake. Maybe in within the illusion of time and space, they appear to be more awake, but being in their presence can only help you to you know, they say when you change your mind, 1,000 of your brothers come with you. And you know that when you're in the presence of people who appear to be more awake than you, it does seem to elevate you. And so I said to this person, I said, I think that there is some benefit to that as long as you don't fall into the habit of idol worship or anything like that. And so what this quote brought to me, the practice that it brought up for me, was to abide with those who have quieted their mind and held steadfast to their practice. Through them, we will grow in our understanding of peace, and also to just remain steadfast in knowing what our desire is when we are around our brothers who seemingly and perhaps are still steadfastly asleep and dreaming. So anyway, I just really love that quote. Thank you for letting me share. There you go.
Yeah, thank you very much, Julie. One friend did say something to me about, I think when she first started using the 7 Steps book, maybe there was this feeling in her that after she read the quote, something very profound needed to come to be written down. And I think when she had that thought that something very profound needed to come to be written down, she actually felt somewhat stuck with the book. And when she released that idea and realized that what came to her could just be very simple, very helpful, having to do with her own life and her own practice, she began to move very quickly and is really loving the book. So I guess that's one thing I want to point out. Notice that both Julie and I are sharing things. You know, they're kind of personal, actually. It's helping us to look at our own self, at our own practice, and notice areas, you know, for lack of better words, I'll call areas of improvement or areas of greater vigilance. And that's at least how the book is working. Sometimes something kind of profound might come through, and that's cool. But I think that if we think that profound, you know, has to be what comes through, then we might get stuck and not use the book properly. So definitely just whatever comes. This is all about looking at ourselves and our own practice. And again, it's about removing obstacles to love's presence moving blocks to love's presence using the words of A Course in Miracles, but also the words that Michael Langford put in the introduction. That's what he said the purpose of this book is to recognize and remove those obstacles. So that's what this is about. All right, number seven says, those who do not dive into the heart and there confront the self in the five sheaths hid, are only students answering out of books clever questions raised by books and not true seekers of the self. Now, I did not know what the five sheaths were, nor did I feel like I understood the quote in this case without knowing what those five sheaths were. So I did go ahead in this case and look them up. And I found that the five sheaths are this. Number one, the belief that the physical body is the self. Number two, the belief that the vital principle is the self. And the vital principle might be the belief that I am the breath, or I am the brain. I think that's one that I really had trouble with for a time. I thought I might be the brain. I am the blood. And in fact, I mentioned I was one of Jehovah's Witnesses. We were not allowed to accept blood transfusions in the case of an accident because the belief was the life was in the blood. So there is a fairly common belief that some vital principle, whether it be the breath, the brain, the blood, the heart, that is what I am. And so that's the second sheath. The third one is that I am the mind, or that I am my thoughts. That is also a very common identification. The fourth one actually is very common, and I know that I have fallen into it repeatedly in my life, but I never even noticed it until I looked up these five sheaths. The fourth one is believing that I am, are you ready for this? The intellectual knowledge that I've acquired through experience, learning, or maturing. For example, a spiritual student might say, I am one who knows that I'm not my thoughts. Yeah, I used to think I am my thoughts, but now I know that I'm not. But there's an identification with that. I am one who knows I am not my thoughts. See the identification that can happen. So that is the fourth sheath, the intellectual knowledge, identifying with that. And the fifth sheath is bliss. You know, believing that I am bliss, or I am peace, or I am happiness, or I am joy. And this would actually, this identification would probably come to actually a fairly advanced spiritual student, someone who had really done a lot of letting go and was really experiencing great bliss, great joy, great peace, but then identifying with that as self. So those are the five sheaths. And so with that said, let's listen to the quote again. Those who do not dive into the heart and there confront the self in the five sheaths hid are only students answering out of books clever questions raised by books and not true seekers of the self. Okay, so now I will read what I wrote in my journal. Regarding the first sheath, the physical body. I wrote about all five of them. Regarding the physical body. Belief that I am the body is questioned in this way. Really what I did was I practiced self-inquiry with all five of them. I felt that's what the quote was asking us to do, so I just went right ahead and did it in my journal. So belief that I am the body is questioned in this way. Am I this leg? Am I this arm? Am I this eye or ear or nose? Realization comes through this type of questioning, that parts of the body can be lost and I am still whole. Therefore, I must not be this body. So if I was the body, if that's what I am, and I lose an arm is cut off in an auto accident or something, then I would no longer be whole, right? But I think we're all aware of the fact that we could lose an arm or a leg or an eye or an ear. We could lose a significant portion of our body, and yet what I am is still whole. So that means, through that inquiry, what we discover is that I can't be the body. If I can be whole, even in a partial body, then I can't be the body, right? So then the second sheath, the vital principle. When belief that I am the body is seen to be untrue, doubt may assert that I am in the vital principle. This belief is questioned by looking and inquiring. Am I my blood? Is what I am limited to the blood? And again, you can look at that and see that's not true, because many people experience, for example, blood transfusions, heart transplants, right? And these organs are replaced, and yet whatever I am is still that same I. It does not become something else because another blood or another heart, another vital organ was replaced. So by questioning this principle, we can see, no, that can't be what I am. In fact, even, let me continue the questioning, then I'll say the next thought. So am I my blood? Is what I am limited to the blood? Am I my breath? Is what I am limited to my breath? You could look at the thought that people can be kept alive through a machine, so you could argue that it's not actually their own breath, and yet the I am is still present. Also, you could argue that the breath could completely die, so that the all of the vital organs die, all the vital principle dies, and yet there is something that is no longer associated with the body, something that we might call spirit or soul, that is still an I am, right? So ultimately, it looks like the breath is not needed at all for the I am to be. Am I my lungs? Is what I am limited to my lungs? Am I this beating heart? Is what I am limited to this beating heart organ? Am I my brain? Is what I am limited to this piece of flesh called brain? So through this type of questioning, we can come to see that I'm really not in any of these vital principles or vital organs. The third sheaf. When it is seen intuitively that I cannot be the body or any vital principle, the idea may come that I am the mind, which is beyond body or vital principle, and survives body and all vital principles. So again, some people might call this the spirit, right? But it's a thinking, perceiving mind that exists beyond the body and beyond any vital principle. So back to the journal. Mind in this case is synonymous with thought or thinking and perceiving, and it may also be called soul or spirit. Regardless of the word used, the idea that I am mind, or I am this thought, thinking, perceiving, right? I am that which, that, all of that, that's what I am. That is questioned in this way. Am I this thought? When this thought is not present, am I present? What am I? Am I these fears? When these fears are not present, am I present? What am I? Am I these feelings? When these feelings are not present, am I present? What am I? So as we begin to question all thought or thinking, perceiving, right, all perception, as we begin to question it, what we come to see is all thought, thinking, perceiving is temporary. I'm the one who thinks it, perceives it, right? And I'm always there as the thoughts and the perceptions come and go. So we come to see that I cannot be the mind. Right? I cannot be the thoughts, the thinking, perceiving. I cannot be that which changes. And Julie has her hand up, so I'll turn it over to her.
Thank you again, Regina. And if ever you just want to finish out all your thoughts and your reading, go ahead, and I'll pick up at the end. But I just wanted to say I love this quote, too. And this quote, for me, gets to the very heart of Ramana's teachings, because his whole teaching is self-inquiry. And in many of his books, you know, he would say, or many of the books that were written about what he said, they say that he would always say that the fastest way to enlightenment is to continually ask the question, who am I? And he called that self-inquiry. So it goes to that that ancient Indian tradition of saying, I am not this, I am not that. I am not this leg, I am not this blood, I am not this mind, I am not this breath, I am not this body, not this, not that. I am the true self, the eternal self. That is the heart of Ramana's teaching, self-inquiry. And it just really, I mean, it just brings chills to me. I get goosebumps, because I really do feel that that is the quickest way to enlightenment, is to understand that you are nothing that you see in the physical world, that you are eternal, and to continually ask that question while quieting the mind of everything else. So thank you. I'm loving this. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Julie. And of course, you know, that's what's happening here. What we're really looking at in my journal is the self-inquiry that I, you know, you could say did live in the journal after reading the quote. And I was really looking at this stuff. I wasn't just writing things down. I was really looking. The fourth thing I looked at, of course, was the idea of acquired knowledge as an identity. And I said, when it is seen that I am not thought, thinking, perceiving, or when it is seen that I am not the body or the vital principle, the idea may come that I am a state of knowledge. The idea that I am any state of knowledge is questioned in this way. Am I one who knows stillness? When I did not know stillness, was I? What am I? Am I one who knows that I am not my thoughts? When I did not know I am not my thoughts, was I? What am I? Am I one who can watch my thoughts or watch awareness? When I did not know how to watch my thoughts or watch awareness, was I? What am I? And through this type of questioning of any state of knowledge that we've identified with, we can see that we are not that state of knowledge, because what we are existed before that state of knowledge was acquired, right? Okay, and then the last one, the fifth sheath, is bliss, or some people may call it peace or joy. When it is seen that I am not acquired knowledge, I am not thought, thinking, perceiving, I am not vital principle, and I am not the body, the idea may come that I am bliss. The idea that I am bliss is questioned in this way. Bliss is experienced now. Has this experience of bliss always been present? What is present for the experience of bliss? What am I? Peace is experienced now. Has this experience of peace always been present? What is present for the experience of peace? What am I? Joy is experienced now. Has this experience of joy always been present? What is present for the experience of joy? What am I? So again, noticing that even these, you know, we could call them these supreme states. These supreme states are not permanent. But what I am is permanent. And so that leads us to see that I am not the supreme state. In fact, I am not anything that comes and goes or anything that can be perceived. I'm going to let Jamie in, and then I'm actually going to come back and read you a little story. I'll be right back. All of this actually reminded me of Muji's painting of the yogini? Let's see, where is it? Let me see if I can find it. Let's see, it's under the prints. Here we go. Yeah, the yogini. And some of you may know that Cheryl Valentine gifted me with the yogini poster at the beginning of this year. And I thought it was a perfect symbol for this year of silence. And when I was doing the self-inquiry based on this seventh quote in the book, I was reminded of the yogini story. So I want to read this story to you. A great yogini, and that, by the way, that's a female yogi. A great yogini was deep in meditation. Suddenly, beautiful and melodious sounds could be heard, appearing as if from nowhere and everywhere simultaneously. It was like nothing she has ever heard. She felt, "This music is truly wonderful, but it cannot be what I am, for I am here to hear it." The music faded away. Next appeared the most exquisite colors, like no painter could paint, nor could any flower display it, for it was not of this earthly realm. She thought, "This is indeed astonishingly beautiful. However, it cannot be who I am, nor can it be real, for it cannot appear if I were not here to perceive it." This phenomenon, too, she ignored. Shortly afterwards, it also vanished in the presence of her deep and unmoving silence. Shortly after this, there appeared several beings, shaped as if from pure light, floating through space and smiling lovingly at her in a welcoming manner. She felt profoundly touched and filled with loving emotions, but inwardly she somehow kept her composure. How profound, she felt. But this also cannot be what is the unchanging reality, for were I not here, who would see them? As soon as this insight occurred, the figures vanished. Her mind entered her heart and could no more produce any effects. A deep silence prevailed as her mind merged inside her indivisible, unconquerable, an essential being, the state known to the yogis as samadhi. So I thought that story was a wonderful, wonderful symbol, because what that story shows is if we identify with anything at all that can be perceived, anything at all that can change, we could even say anything at all that can be an object, then we have missed our true self. And that's really what the heart of this quote is about, the five she's, as Julie was explaining. It's about realizing that we can't be anything that can be perceived in any way, anything that can be an object in any way, anything that can be changing or temporary in any way. And by really remembering that, then we can pass on the multitude of temptations to identify with something that isn't what we are. And as we pass on the multitude of temptations to identify with something that we aren't, well, then we make ourselves available to spontaneously realize that which we are. All right, so that was all quote number 7. Okay, so quote number 8. The knowledge that ignores the self, the knower, and holds as true the field perceived, is but elusive folly. No matter how much one has learned, true knowledge is the merging of all indicative knowledge in awareness of the self. And at least for me, that quote follows perfectly the story of the yogini, right? Because she did not hold as true anything that she perceived, not no matter how heavenly it seemed to be, right? Or how profound it seemed to be. She realized it can't be true because, as she said, I am here to perceive it. She realized the difference between that which was constant and that which wasn't. Again, the quote, "The knowledge that ignores the self, the knower, and holds as true the field perceived, is but elusive folly. No matter how much one has learned, true knowledge is the merging of all indicative knowledge in awareness of the self." All right, so this is my journal. "It is not the knowledge that defines what I am. I am not what I have learned. My isness is not, I am one who knows, dot, dot, dot. And in fact, focus on knowledge as meaningful to identity distracts from that which I am, that which is before any knowing, and continues constant as knowing seems to shift and change. Notice when mind places identity with any object of knowledge. Inquire into the nature of self immediately instead of staying in attachment to an idea of knowing as who I am. Watch even the idea, I am one who knows." And when I went through the five sheaths and when I did the self-inquiry on the five sheaths, this is when I realized that I had, over and over again — it's actually kind of funny if you look at it because it doesn't make sense — but I had over and over again in my lifetime identified with acquired knowledge. You know, so I might say something like, I am one who realizes the Holy Spirit is not separate from us. Like, I can identify with that. I am someone who knows that. But, you know, if we're practicing self-inquiry like is being taught here, I can break that identification as quickly as the mind tries to make it by noticing, wait a minute, have I always known that? Have I always known that the Holy Spirit is not separate from us? Well, no, there was a time when I thought of the Holy Spirit as separate from me. Well, during that time, did I still exist? Was I present? Yes. Well, then what is the I? It can't be the one who knows this, because that I is constant and that knowledge is changing. So for me, this was actually a new insight. Maybe for some of you, you already caught onto this. Now that I see it — see, I just didn't see it before. Now that I see it, to me, it's a ridiculous point of identification, because it's so obvious that we can't be that which we know. But I realize that I've identified with that which I know many, many times, and I'm sure the habit will persist until the self-inquiry knocks it out, right? So that's quote number 8. All right, I think we have time for at least one more, so let's move on to quote number 9. "The one true light there is pure awareness. Other kinds of knowledge clinging to it and claiming to be real are ego-born conceptual clouds. To trust them is sheer folly." There's that word again, folly. "The one true light there is pure awareness. Other kinds of knowledge clinging to it and claiming to be real are ego-born conceptual clouds. To trust them is sheer folly." All right, here's my journal. "Pure awareness is the only truth. All other ideas and images are like passing clouds and therefore not truth. be aware of the passing cloud that you are now giving the strength of truth. It is a distraction from truth for you. Instead of being immersed in the cloud, step back and notice what is being immersed. What is it that was present before this cloud, is present now, and will be present when this cloud is forgotten? Watch that. Observe that. Be immersed in that. Now, earlier today, I read another entry in my journal that talked about whenever a story is trying to be born in the mind, to just look for the source of where this story came from where did the story come, and looking within yourself for the source of the story, you find that it really just kind of emerged out of silence. And then instead of focusing on the story, focus on the silence and let the story die before it's even fully born. And I mentioned to you that sometimes that is very easy for me when there isn't a lot of interest in the story. You could say when the story comes from a root that is really already healed in me. But I also mentioned that sometimes that's very difficult. That particular practice is very difficult for me when the story does seem to have a lot of interest. In fact, I use the word practically impossible. It's practically impossible for me if there's a lot of interest in the story, or if the story comes from an unhealed root in my mind, to just return to the silence and let the story die before it's even born. However, this practice that we just read in my journal is one that I can do with those stories that seem to have more power and that are, you know, really forcing themselves, it seems like, into my mind as full-blown stories. Again, probably because of some unhealed root. What I can do is look at the story and see the story as a passing cloud. It doesn't matter how big of a storm it is, I know that it's temporary. I know that I was before this story or concern, that I am now, even as this story and concern seems to be demanding so much attention, and that I will be after this story has died. And when I lock into that realization, then I am able to focus on I am instead of the story. And I can step into more the observer role of the story instead of the one involved in the story. So it's nice to have two different practices. One, just returning to the silence immediately and not even letting the story get born. I think that is probably the preferred choice. You don't even let the cloud develop. But if for some reason there seems to be so much power behind it that for some reason that doesn't seem possible, then even as the story is existing, I can begin to question, what am I? You know, am I really this concern, this cloud, this story? And it's very easy to see that I am not, because I was here before and I will be here long after this story is gone. And then I focus on that I am that is constant. So I'm happy that we were able to talk about both of those in one day, since they're kind of two practices for me, and between the two, there's always a practice that can be used. So that means we read all the way up through quote number 8. So I will just kind of, is that right, 8? No, we read through 9. So I will just mark my notebook so that we can start with 10 next week. How's that sound? I'll just put a little mark here. And then next week we will begin with 10. If you have not yet begun the 7 steps to awakening, and you want to, you know, just join in whenever you get your book. I've heard the books can take a long time to be delivered, so be patient. And I will see everyone on Friday when I come back to teach Original Edition with Lynn. Thank you for joining me for the 7 Steps Journal. Thank you, Julie, for your input. Bye.